So first, let's recap. What we learned yesterday is that in D equals 2, that conformal transformation is really just any holomorphic. So if you send Z to some function of Z that doesn't depend on Z bar, it's automatically a conformal transformation. And then you have an algebra of the form of this guy. And you have the other set. And then you have the condition they don't talk to each other. And then we also see that some of transformations are more special. So this is known as the local group, conformal group. And you can also do some transformation that is valid everywhere globally. Well, namely 0 and infinity. And you discover it's of this form in some very extensive way with condition that this is 1. And you have it divided by a Z2 symmetry. And what you discovered is this group is a special linear in 2 dimension with complex number divided by the double cover, which is equivalent to the global, the conformal group you would have found if you just assumed D is anything. And then you take D equals 2. So, sorry, I'm slightly confused. Suddenly the number of students increased by like 50%. Okay, so we have a local conformal transformation, local group, global transformation, global group. And then next we say, oh, remember the VIP players are called the primary field. And either tomorrow or on Thursday, we'll see why they are so important. But what really we need today is to recall that this thing at a new point, so I'll just be happily only caring about the Carroll part, a Carroll primary field would transform like this. And it is scaled using the new notation with a conformal weight with a holomorphic conformal weight H respect to the original point. Okay, you have seen this last week when you were in general dimension, and this is just how it looks like in 2 dimension. And then, of course, you have a lot of information about this guy. You can calculate all the correlations functions are determined in some sense. Well, you have some conformal data, but we'll come back to those correlation functions in the last lecture and to say why we claim that they actually are determined. And you can solve everything and all that. But what you have seen yesterday in the tutorial is an important fact, is that normally you think energy momentum tensor should be a 2x2 matrix. So well, it's symmetric, so there should be have 3 entries. And naively, I couldn't really expect that they only depend on Z and not Z bar, except because we have conformal symmetry. What you have shown is that the traceless condition get rid of the TZZ bar component, and the energy momentum conservation tells us TZZ is only a function of Z, or in other words, the partial bar of this guy vanish. And the partial of T, Z bar, Z bar vanish. Okay. so that with some factor of 2 pi and also a minus sign, that you can check out the big orange or yellow book depending on when you buy it, the different Chesco book, then you realize there's a normalization factor that would matter later. But his definition is that this is defined to be minus 2 pi times t zz. And similarly for the other one. Okay, so that shouldn't be a surprise. We have seen together in the class and in the tutorial. What we also seen yesterday is that suppose I have a cylinder. Which is described by x0 going this direction, and x1 being the periodic direction, this guy can be mapped onto the complex plane. Okay, but before I go into more detail about the tutorial problem that you have all already seen, let's have some motivation about this. Well, why do I care about a cylinder? Well, suppose you care about string theory. You take a closed string, let it propagate in time, you get a cylinder. Okay, well, there are always people, you know, who not care about string theory. And so we have another motivation, is that you must have done a lot of this integral, and yeah, I'm sure Dan has a lot of assignments ask you to do momentum integrals. And then the claim is that normally the integral comes with something k to some power which comes from the propagators. So you have something running in the loop, you want to integrate over it, and you have some momentum on the bottom, and then that has a propagator on the bottom, and you want to evaluate it in this integral. And then, you know, you run into trouble if d is large. Then this integral might diverge, which is known as the UV divergence. And then, you know, you have some dark magic of getting rid of the divergence, or sweep them under the carpet and such things. Well, string theory claim they resolve this because you have two strings. And if you draw two strings interact and they become one string, it looks like a pair of pants. You can't really identify, hey, they interact at that one point. There's always some, like, you can't get too close to each other. So you can't get too big a momentum. That you will get the detail about that in the string theory course. But there is also something called IR divergence when momentum is very small. As you see, if momentum is very small, especially we live in d equals 2, we might have an IR divergence problem. And then string theory says, look, we solve everything. If you can compactify your dimension into a circle, your momentum can't be too small either because momentum is quantized. You have a smallest momentum. So you safely says, okay, very good. If you put things on a cylinder, it's great. We don't have a divergence problem. But cylinders are not that easy to study. So we're gonna see one way to derive the Virasoro algebra today. And then you can also try to do that thing on a cylinder, which is much more complicated. That will defer it to the string theory part as well. But okay, suppose we're interested in the cylinder. What you have seen yesterday is that if you just take the cylinder and tie this end up and squash it down, which can be formally expressed as a conformal transformation, but you manage to map this onto the complex plane. It's really just stepping on the cone. And then, well, okay, to be technically correct. You map to the complex plane without the origin, because the cylinder has, you know, two holes. It's like a sphere with two holes, and the complex plane may have a one hole at the infinity. Okay. Nevertheless, I believe yesterday we have seen is that I quietly leave myself in the Euclidean space, but what you have seen is if this is some equal times, there's a closed string propagated here, and then it gets mapped onto a circle. Like a circle centered at the origin. So this is that guy. And then, if you see the string propagate to the future, it gets to map to a bigger circle. And what you realize, this is called time. On the complex plane, this is called the radius direction. And then furthermore, one important effect will be important next lecture is that you manage to map minus infinity in the infinite past into the origin. As you have taken many quantum field theory class, a large number of them, you might have heard of things called time ordering. So whenever I'm interested in some correlation functions of some fields, then we want them to be time ordered. And you might have heard about the path integral explanation. Is that the Feynman says, if you go from one point to the other point, you want to integrate all paths, and you can just insert a screen in the middle. It says you have to reach the first screen and then reach the next screen. And then you just discretize all your space-time, and then you realize everything got to be time ordered. Okay, and then now time ordering, since time is radius, so what do we care on the complex plane? Is the radial order. We still care about it. So far, this is what we have seen so far. Okay? No questions? And today, since we live on a complex plane, so an integral become very important. Which is Cauchy integral, you must have done some of them. It says you do some integral, then you pick up the pole. If you do, you know, 1 over z, you pick up the simple pole, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, there is a interesting notation. It's like h bar is h over 2 pi. This d bar z is just equals to dz over 2 pi I. Otherwise, I have to write the 2 pi really a lot of times. And I can't keep track of it. Okay, just make your formula look nicer. So that integral we'll have to use a large number of times today. So as I promised, we're going to learn this Virasoro algebra today. I have no idea what this algebra has done, that the people name it the Virasoro algebra. I think it's a pretty happy thing to look at. Well, it depends on how do you derive it. Maybe some of them are really painful. Anyway, so we have derived a lot of algebra together, especially with doing the group theory too. So we must have seen a lot of times. So if I say, I say, find me an algebra, your first reaction should be, okay, let me find the generators. And then let me do the commutator. The process might be painful, but the steps are clear. Okay, so for the generators, today we're going to use what we did in group theory, Group theory says if I have a symmetry and say that when you do such a transformation, it will have effect on our operator or field. And this effect infinitesimally is captured by some generating acting on operator. And then, you know, you might have seen the exponential form, so this is the infinitesimal form. So if you have a finite transformation, then you just exponential it. You do it like a large n number of times and chop it down to infinitesimal, then you get something e to the I alpha theta if you're talking about a U1. Right? So it's always coming with some infinitesimal parameters. And then you wonder how the generator is acting on phi. And then that's just how much the phi will change. So that's how we're going to find our generators. And then we're going to try to find the commutators. So commutator has the following property. Commutator is actually this algebra. Lie algebra has the following property. The first property is it's a binary operator. The rest are irrelevant. Irrelevant. But for my argument, why the next step is important, we only care that it's a binary operator means that you start with two operators and it's get mapped to one. So the first step, we're going to look at something called the commutator operator product relationship. It's a very interesting thing. On the complex plane, the equal time or equal radius commutators is equivalent to study the operator product. So we're going to see that very soon, because we want to talk about the radial ordering. You have to get things ordered to then to do everything else. So after that, you have an operator product. So it's if you have been taking the first week's class, it shouldn't surprise you that we're going to use OPE to fuse these two operators together to become one operator. So we could take two steps to do this binary map. First, we get rid of this commutator thing and it says it's just an operator product. And then we use OPE to fuse them together and we'll get one operator. Okay, make sense? And after that, we can come back to actually calculate the commutator and find this algebra. Okay, so that's the roadmap of today. Clear? So first, let's start with radial ordering. As I said, we should get things ordered before we move on. Okay, so the following definition shouldn't surprise you at all. You must have seen this in QFT that I want to know what do I mean by radial ordering two things. Well, you say, I would love to put the guy that happened last first. So if Z is in the outsider circle, then W, then I put this guy in front, otherwise I switch. Nothing fancy. Okay, now, so that's just a radial ordering. And now we're going to be interested in a mathematics fun fact or some curiosity lead us to ask such a question. Well, this fun fact will be very useful later. But the fun fact is, which mathematicians are very interested in this, it says, suppose I have an operator here, and I have an operator here. And the question I want to ask is, what if I bring it to do a circle and come back? Well, if nothing changes, then it will be trivial. But if it changes, it's known as a monodromy, which is what mathematicians are interested to know. And a monodromy, in a very common sense, is if you go to the water slide, and you're doing circles, it just says you're moving in a circle, and you didn't go back to your original place. And in our sense, we reflect as doing a contour integral, and the result is non-zero. Okay, so this is interesting to know. So we're trying to do an integral when z is a circle around w. And we ask this question, what this thing is. Okay, in order to do this contour integral, okay, when I do anything, we should remember they are radially ordered. Because we're interested in correlation function, the correlation function automatically radial ordered. So it's always radial ordered. But if now I want to do this integral, I'm running into some sort of trouble because z and the w seems to be changing their ordering from time to time as I follow my contour. So I meant to draw a circle. Right. Assume this thing is a circle at the w. So what we could do is that we can deform a contour somehow. Says that we could do integral here. Ha. And then do integral there. And then see since we can take this, so we're taking some contour very close to this original contour and just fill the rest part by a circle. And whenever we're interested in what happens when two operators are close, we always imagine if there is, you know, other things, they are very far away, so there are no poles. And since contour integral really only cares about some insertions, I can deform my contour however I wish. So what I'm claiming is this contour, let's give it a name C, is equals to C2 minus C1. So I could do C2 and do C1 backwards and do the last part of little C1. Okay? So what I want to do is along contour C2, and along contour C2, I mean, the reason I do this is along contour C2, since it's completely outside the orange thing, so the radial order is clear. Z is bigger than W. And on the other contour, C1, it's also clear W is always bigger than Z. I mean, in the mod sense. Okay. So now I can do the Euro trick is to take them to be really close. So the next step is take a limit such that epsilon goes to zero, and we make the C2 contour really, really close to C1 contour. When epsilon is going to zero, those contour actually goes so close, they basically become this orange circle. Okay? So this is the limit I'm taking. If I take those two operators to be ridiculously close together, there's no difference between the green contour and the blue contour. They are this, the same contour. They're both the orange contour. And so this guy just become integrating over the orange contour. And now we can write them together, which we recognize as a commutator. And it's actually equal time, because now Z and W are both on the orange contour. Interesting fun fact, we just shown that the commutator, equal time commutator, or equal radial commutator, can be written as a contour integral, can be written as the product of operators. You just have to keep track where your contour is. So we accomplished step 2.A, I guess, is the commutator indeed can be replaced by operator product. Okay, so let's leave this fun fact there, and then start to look for generators. Okay, so generators. Remember, what I want to say is that the derivative phi is equals to something which generates the change in phi. So following this idea, basically we want to find the derivative phi. David promised me that you have seen this, says if we have a symmetry, derivative phi can be written as a commutator of the conserved charge with the phi. And then if you forget this, you either check your classical mechanics note, or you can check the note today in the appendix that shows why this is true. But I assume you have seen this. Okay. And then, let's see what kind of charge we want to study. First of all, let me emphasize again, CFT is a thing that doesn't have to have an action. We only know it's some physical theory, has some field, but the thing we know for sure is it has an energy momentum tensor. An energy momentum tensor is conserved, and you must have also seen this. So recall, the charge is something, if I write it in two dimension, it's the integral over space of the first the time component of the current, and the current is something that conserved. And the argument for this is that we can always use the divergence theorem, says that we'll push everything to the boundary, and normally what you do is you push the boundary at the infinity and they claim everything vanished there. Except that this argument really works on a cylinder, because our space is a circle. It doesn't even have a boundary. So boundary term, well, if you don't have a boundary, then the boundary term definitely vanish. So if you got a current that is conserved, you definitely have a charge with it. Okay, so what we have, remember, is this guy. This guy, if you want to make it in a current, you normally contract it with our Killing vector. And then you have seen last week that this guy is indeed a conserved. Since that's the only thing we know about the theory, which is the energy momentum tensor, which comes from the space-time symmetry, and we can build a current in it, And since we are still studying the conformal group, the algebra of the conformal group, except we want to upgrade it into, in a quantum sense. Before we just use geometry, now we want to actually have a theory which comes with a conserved energy momentum tensor. So I hope it's not, you can do the exercise changing your coordinate and that such, but I find that it's not very enlightening, so I'm going to take a leap of faith and tell you that the result of going from there, combining with this, going to the complex coordinate will result in this. As you know, killing vector energy momentum tensor integrated over the space. Makes sense, and that minus sign is coming from what I mentioned, that there is this normalization factor to make some word identities groups. And also there is the anti-holomorphic part, which I never bothered to write down, and I just hope that it didn't work. So this is the chart we're going to use to find our variation of our operator. So the next thing to do is I'm just plugging it in. Okay. And now we see a common error inside the counter integral by the fun fact we just learned 5 minutes ago. I can replace it by an integral that is time ordered. And we could carefully track that, but let's just say that there is some contour specified here, and now it's become contour C, C prime. But what we have seen is that the commutator can be replaced by just the product of the operator. Okay. And the next step is, well, let's try to be simple, make our life simple. It's a good thing to do in life. And take only one of these guys. Remember that our killing vector is literally everything that is holomorphic. So I can do a Laurent expansion, and now I'm just taking one of them. Just making my life easier. Nothing fancy. Okay, now I want to compare this to what I have here. Sure. This should be fine, that means minus 17. Okay. I want this to equals minus An, some generator, which for the energy momentum tensor somehow it's called L. And I really want this to happen. Because our goal is to calculate the change in the operator and to call that, from that extract the generator. Okay? And this will happen if Tz, we expand Tz in the following way. So if Tz has a Laurent expansion, which I don't see why not. Then we can plug this expansion into that contour integral. Maybe let me use another letter, M. And then you realize from Cauchy integral, it'll pick up the term when M equals N, which there's a single pole, and then Ln will be picked up. Right? So we realize the generator we are seeking after of the conformal group is really just some wrong expansion coefficient of the Carroll field Tz. That's the moral of the story. That's why, you know, I have to go through this, otherwise we're like, you have an interesting expansion exponent. Or I could as well write this guy also as a contour integral of z to the m plus 1. You just plug this guy back in, the same argument when there's a simple pole, it'll get a picked up. Okay? And now, we get our generators. They are, not surprisingly, related to our energy momentum tensor, which is conserved because of our signature. And now, we should really charge ahead to calculate this guy, which is the goal of the today, known as the algebra of the generators. Before that, remember, what we accomplished so far is that if I really charge forward to do this, what I can safely say is I can get rid of the commutator, but I still have an operator product to deal with. In order to map that onto a single operator, I need to OP. Okay. So since you guys have already seen OP, I'll just say that very quickly, OP, the idea of OPE is there's O1 and Z1, O2 and Z2. And then there are some other irrelevant things. They are far away in the sense you can draw a circle, put a Z1, Z2 inside, everything else is out. And then the idea of OPE is I can replace this guy by a tower of all sorts of operators sitting at Z2 with some coefficients. Some coefficients that is not an operator anymore. It might still depend on your Z1 minus Z2 and such. But let me ignore that. Okay, and then more dot dot. And then the intuition is also very clear that the things cut close to each other from far away. They seem like one. See, if you make me take off my glasses, I can see all of you guys are like, okay. So this is the idea of OP. And now our goal would be, let's calculate some operator product expansion. And interestingly, still without knowing what's the underlying theory. Okay, we don't really have an underlying theory, and I want to calculate the operator product expansion. What is available? Well, we have our primary field. We have our energy momentum tensor. So an interesting question to ask, what would happen if I brought them together? Well, you should know what happened if I brought two primary fields together. That's a correlator you already get. So the next thing interesting would be bring the Carroll field Tz close to a primary field with conformal weight H. And you wonder, what is this? Okay. Normally you write OPE with a curly sign. That just means for OPE purpose, we only care about a singular curve. And we throw anything that is finite and regular. Because remember, these two points are supposed to be very close. So those are infinitely larger than the rest of the term. Also, you only care about in the contour integral.
So only pose matters. Okay? So how do we do that? We do that by realizing, wait, I need to show up here, right? So if I somehow can find another expression of this guy, I will be able to find OP. So the trick we use to find this guy is called the delta phi mass equals delta phi. So if I somehow manage to calculate that two ways, then equal them each other, and one way is this way, and the other way hopefully gives me something else, I can just compare my result and read off what this thing should be. Well, there is also a third way that defines our generator. So we really say, let's try to figure out how primary field transform under conformal transformation. And this, it shouldn't be a surprise. We have seen it. We know exactly how primary field transform. That's how we define it. We define the things transform this nicely, like this nicely, I meant, if phi tilde and fz is given by partial f to minus h phi z, we call it a primary. Right? So let's do this and trying to find what's the infinitesimal version, which is defined the new field at the same location, subtract the old field. Right? I want to calculate what's the change in the operator. It doesn't make sense if they're not at the same location. Okay, so let me just expand this guy in the infinitesimal sense. So first, I'll just write it down as taking fz equals z plus some infinitesimal things. And so this guy would be 1 plus partial epsilon to the minus h by z. Okay? And this is called the Taylor expansion. I'm going to expand around this point, so I'm going to get partial epsilon times partial phi. And z. Okay, and the other side I get 1 minus h partial epsilon. It's just a first order expansion. And then since this one is already at epsilon, I can just erase this. I only keep the linear term, so whatever the difference is the second order, I don't care. So now I can read off delta phi is minus epsilon partial phi minus h partial epsilon phi. Okay. The only thing you do is do some linear expansion on both sides, and then you read off what's the difference. Okay. Now what I do? Now what do we do is that how do I do this? This formula is here, so it's probably better to do this one. Oh.
Take it down?
Take it down.
And now.
Magic. Apparently it doesn't commute.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Now commute. Don't commute in geometry of the blackboard. Could it be some research topic? Okay, what I have over there is that I realized that an infinitesimal transformation of a primary field is always this. Okay. Well, if I really want to equal these two guys, they are equal, but if I really want to read off the OPE, in the sense that I should actually rewrite this as a Comfort interval. Okay. So what we do is, I'll just write out the RP. They are all at the boundary. All these guys are at the boundary. So if we look at the set, this guy seems to be fine. I have find W already. Is this guy is problematic? I want it to be somewhere else at Z, for example. So I'm gonna write this as the counter integral of epsilon Z over Z minus W. And this guy is just tagging along for the ride. Okay, that's just application of this one n equals one. Ignore this. This guy just moves over there. The only thing I'm doing is that epsilon W is the residue of this integral. Okay. Then we do this again for the other guy. And now we realize. Now what I'm interested in is partial epsilon. So this guy would need a double pole. And again, the phi is just typing off. Right? Some inverse using of the Cauchy integral reveal these guys. So now I can compare. Because now they all share a minus sign in the integral and some epsilon z. So whatever I read off from the rest must be the OPE I'm looking for. And we were left with is a simple pole with partial phi on top, and a double pole with h phi on top, and who knows what else. Regular terms, we don't care. Okay, so that's pretty good. From knowing nothing about the theory, but knowing there exists a primary field, we can already write down the OP. Then sometimes people actually just use this to define a primary field. Say, I have no idea how primary field will transform under a symmetry, but I can do some measurements to see how it behaves with the correlation function of Tz. So they do some measurements, they realize, the singular behavior is like this. The first term is like this, the second term comes with an H, and then there's no other poles, then we call this a primary field. Okay. So this is actually a very important and a sort of longish derivation. So we'll tell you a very random thing. The question is, so what do you learn from, say now you have learned quantum field theory from Dan, and learned the conformal field theory from me. So what you conclude is, Dan tells you none of the infinities matters, you can sweep them under the carpet. And now I tell you none of the finite terms matters, you can sweep them under the carpet. If you combine them, all your calculation equals zero, because you throw everything away. Okay, so that's our first important OPE. And the next thing to do was, the last thing we can do without knowing further about the theory is you wonder what happens if you bring Z, Tz, and Tw together. It's a quasi-primary. It turns out that it's these two terms we just calculated still exist. You still have a simple pole like this, you still have a double pole like this, and the coefficient is 2, Remember, energy momentum tensor need to be integrated over the space, so space-time. So it's conformal with is 2, and it doesn't have the anti-holomorphic part, so it must be 2, 0. Okay. So you can write on this term, but then there's some underscored things do matter, and there's some regular terms with the ruler. And the question is, what else come out of it? So you can make some educated guess. First of all, let's talk about the Bose symmetry. So if you switch Z and the W, it shouldn't matter. That would kill you the third pole. It happened to not kill this because you can do some expansion, and I realize this term actually does agree with the Bose symmetry. And then the next term will be the quadratic, the fourth pole. As this pole happens to exist, and come with a coefficient of C over 2. And then you know there's no further, because you're bringing a field with conformal with 2 and another field with conformal with 2 together. So the smallest singular pole is 4. So it's done. And then a lot of interesting thing about conformal field theory is to figure out what's the C number is, which you have heard a lot about in last week. This is known as the central charge of the CFT. As you have seen, since all the theory has the rest part the same, so the central part actually tell you which conformal field theory we're actually studying. And this also controls the conformal anomaly, which you will see it again in Davide's course. And then also it gives you the flow, indication of the flow of the conformal field theory. If you flow from UV to IR, and this is the indicator that monotonic decrease. And then, even more importantly, well, the other importance is that actually next two lectures we're going to use symmetry to constrain this C number even more. And what we discover is in D equals 2, some mathematician finish all the infinite steps and give you a complete list of the model, called the minimum models of a bunch of Cs that come with a certain number of primary fields. So as all the 2D CFT that are minimal has been listed. So they're characterized by C.
And can you repeat again why Z minus omega to the minus 4 is the lowest pole?
Because you are bringing two operator that is conformal with 2. So if you think about the conformal transformation of that, again, the transform as D1 over D2.
Okay.
So if you bring two of those together, you can expect you get Z1 over D4. They all... You can just study all the theory and find all the singular parts and find the do ending. Okay, so for the last 6 minutes, I'll try to do this commutator as I promised, which is slightly long, and I might get lost. So let's try. Okay, now we can finally do this. And we'll find the algebra. Okay. So this guy is first, let's replace it by the definition of this guy, which is Tz, and another contour integral, let's call it dw. Okay, and the next step is pull the integral out for some reason later will be clear. I'll decide to do the z integral first, since I'm not a mathematician. I'll just do the easy one first and then assume the commute. And now, remember that what I can do is I have a commutator of tz, tw. I can replace that by the operator product, and we can replace that by the operator product expansion. So that's where this chunk comes in. I'm going to write in the reverse order, because the first two, they are pretty easy to figure out what they are. They are just a bunch of counterintegrals. Okay, so now we just have to do two counterintegrals and be happy with our life. Okay, the first step is this crazy quadruple pull, but that just means I have to take three derivatives on this guy. And come with 1 over 3 factorial, which is 6. So it's c over 12. And then it has n plus 1, n minus 1. And then z to the n minus 2. But after you do the integral, it becomes double. Okay. So that's one counter integral. And the next guy would be doing one derivative on this guy, so it's a 2 n plus 1 z to the n dw. And the next one is the easiest, is a simple pull, so it's w to the n plus 1 partial tw. Okay, now we just need to finish integral at it. Oh, maybe there's another four. Oh, there is. Well, interesting. At least it's a symmetric. Okay. So bear with me with this counter integral. And now I can pull all these guys ahead of the exponential numbers. And then the integral of that guy vanishes unless n plus m equals 0, right? You just want a simple pull out of this. So if n plus m is 0, it's a simple pull. And then the next term is that n plus, well, the next term, let me keep the boundary. So it's integral of dw, and w to the n plus 1, easy, dw. Okay, let's leave this guy alone. And for the other guy, let's integral by parts, because I want, the partial t is no use of me. I want a counter integral of t, so it will give me back the generator. So let's integral by parts and get n plus 2, and then again integral of dw, wn plus n plus 1, because I need a derivative on it. And then now again it's dw. But this guy is nothing but the l m plus 1, so we get all this crazy thing, all this term. And this part equals n minus m, l n plus m, which you shouldn't be very surprised, because we have this before. The only difference is now there is this part related to central charge. So we have this before, that's why it's called L, it's related to the weight algebra. And notice some fun fact, if n equals minus 1, 1, 0, if it's global symmetry, then there is no central charge term. So the global conformal group is not modified quantum mechanically. It's only all the rest of the infinite tower is modified.
Sorry, can you say that again?
So if you look at this term,
yeah.
If you take n equals 0 or 1 or minus 1, this discrete.
Okay.
So which means for the global symmetry, which is L1, M of L minus 1, L0, and the counterpart partners, it's not a modified quantum. But it is indeed modified for all the rest of them, by exactly characterized by exactly one number, which is the central charge, which described the which CFT you are studying. So this is the celebrated Virasoro algebra. And we're done today. And tomorrow, since we have the algebra, let's find the representation of this guy. It's not that important. So we'll build a Hilbert space and says, look, I have primary field and all their descendants. And they will go and form a representation on all the cool stuff. And then the last lecture is the really cool stuff. It's when we realize, look, there's some miracle happens that in very special cases, we can get rid of some parts of the representation and then find out, because you have an infinite number of constraints. And the constraints are so much, you start with a HC plane, so C is the central part, H is the component. And if you constrain it infinitely, so the thing you're left with is the zero set. So you're only literally left with some dots. So it's only H and a C are all constrained to be very specific. Before you thought the whole plane is a zero. In the end, we have a fine, infinite, but a countable number of things. All right. See you tomorrow.